From Hyphen Magazine, I'm Christian Ting, your TV and film editor, and we have a very special guest. He's the writer, director, and star of the upcoming Focus Features film, Blue Bayou. It's Justin Chan. Justin, how's it going?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. So as I had mentioned earlier, a lot of this feels truly full circle, having the chance to interview one of your old co-stars, David So, back on Gook. And, you know, since that time in 2017 till now, I've been following your career very, very specifically. And I wanted just to, first of all, congratulate you on your upcoming film. You must feel a sense of relief that not only it's done, but we're kind of at the end point of, you know, towards the premiere. So congratulations on that front. And also just a side note too, my girlfriend and I recently watched Soul Searching again. It's kind of like our feel good whenever the moment calls. So again, it's been a full Justin week. So this is a part of that process. So thank you again for taking time with us. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So again, I want to keep this super organic, and just to start things off, I want to note that, you know, throughout your directing career, you've embarked on the path of making films that are both reflexive and intentional, and whether they be pulling from historical moments or about interpersonal relationships, especially featuring Asian American characters. With Blue Bayou, where did the inspiration start for you?
Especially being Korean American, the idea of international adoption all originated from Korea. You know, international adoption as we know it started in Korea after the Korean War. And so naturally, you know, there's a lot of Korean American adoptees. So I grew up with some. And it's always been in my sphere, you know, so the idea of the adoptee experience, I feel like is really so integral to the Asian American experience. I think it's included, and I didn't feel in the narrative space that it's quite been given its attention, you know. And when I started hearing from adoptee friends that this issue was happening where adoptees were being deported, It was actually shocking, you know. And I just felt that it was an important issue to shed a light on, and hopefully, I could get it to the masses and hope some change can come of it. It was my driving force to make the film. I'm not an adoptee. I don't know what it feels like to be, you know, adopted or have that experience. I did everything I could to try to make the portrayal in the film as authentic as I knew how I could, you know, much as I can, but of course, like, some adoptees will not like that I'm not adopted, I'm telling their story, you know. But I do think it comes down to intention of why I wanted to do it. Is I do want to service them and represent them in the narrative, in cinema and in film. That's how I kind of came about this story and then embarking on this journey to make this film.
Yeah. I think one particular note that I found really compelling was the fact that a lot of times in sort of the small reserves of actual, like, media depictions of both the Korean adoptees and just Asian American adoptee culture, we really haven't seen, like, an adoptee in, like, the later part of their life. In the case of an Antonio character who is, you know, firmly planted within the U.S. and had some time to really develop and ruminate on his own culture. A lot of times I feel like a lot of media focuses in on, like, the arrival as opposed to, like, the extenuation, that time for them to develop again their character and their cultural identity, which becomes what it seems is the basis of the film's tension and its release. So
also something I'd like to mention is, like, it's not American, but, you know, you look at a film like Lion, and he had a nice family, you know. So a lot of the experiences that you see, you know, regarding adoptees is told through rose-colored glasses. That's not the case. And that's one of the primary issues of this film is, you know, sometimes when U.S. citizens bring children over, they decide they don't want the child, what happens? I mean, they go through the foster care system. And do you think their parents really cared enough to follow through with naturalizing them? And it costs money, it costs lawyer fees, like, you know, and then so yeah. These people who become adults never have, you know, officially become U.S. citizens, even though they were brought by U.S. citizens. You know, this film is also, you know, shows how the system can fail, you know, not really be there for an adoptee as well.
I think like the confluence of both sort of like the failures and the flaws structurally is within like the adoptee program that again transferred and kind of like intersected with the foster care system is like a subtle critique that doesn't offer a lot in the ways of the solutions, because as you and I both keenly aware, these issues are inherently super complex and they require a lot of both systemic and logistical and honestly like political changes to really kind of rally yes. and support around. But I think the beauty of art is its ability, and especially with films like this, and obviously just like the entire canon of films that you have like, you know, focused your attention on, of offering something that feels a level of grit and a level of authenticity. I know a film that gave you a lot of inspiration for Gook was La Haine, the French film. And something
yes,
that
really it, yeah, it was.
Something that really jumped out of those films. And what I find is kind of like a thread of DNA in yours is just, there isn't a glamorization of this. There is a sense of it, you know, yeah. being grounded and oftentimes uncomfortable, but like a lot of times that is reflexive of our reality. And so speaking of the groundedness, I'm so curious, like what drew you to specifically New Orleans for the character of the city, as well as why this became sort of the focal point of its visual identity for the film. Had you visited before prior to this, and what was the inspiration?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I have spent quite a bit of time in New Orleans, and nice. It's somewhere that I truly love and holds a close place to my heart. I feel like the city is incredibly resilient. You know, they deal with a lot of natural disasters and somehow they still have a beautiful spirit and carry on. And I felt like that was very synonymous with the Antonio spirit. Another reason is because there is a huge Vietnamese enclave there. And one of the goals for this film was to have two Asian ethnicities in one film. You know, we're usually relegated to the allowance of one ethnicity per film. We're not allowed to have two. And I just question that, because why are we not allowed to see ourselves interact with one another on screen? And, you know, commiserate, you know, or, you know, find differences or yeah. find, you know, similarities and connect. So that was another reason. And then also like in film and television, I never seen Asian Americans with a Southern accent. We're there. We exist there. Yet, you know, we're not allowed to have that experience on screen either. You know, it's such a novelty to see an Asian American with, a Southern accent. And frankly, I don't think it needs to be a novelty.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, part of it for me is trying to normalize that and be like, you know, no, this is what it is as well. And it's not a gimmick. It's not like the focal point of the film. That's why the first scene you see is him speaking with this accent with the tattoos and a white stepchild, and it's in your face. I don't cut away. So then you have to deal with it. You have to deal with it for a few minutes. You can't turn away. And then you forget about it. It just becomes normal because it's about exposure. So these are the reasons I definitely said it in New Orleans, absolutely. Those are the main reasons.
I was going to say, like, the only time I remember, like, in popular culture, like, an Asian person on screen using, a rural affectation with some, like, Chinese singing show where this man basically sings, like, a country song. And I'm like, you know, there's probably real people out there in the diaspora who probably are one offended or be like, you know, this is a clear just, like, you know, appropriation of a culture in a context. That was a perfect segue yeah. because, like what you just said, I really felt like in the whole sort of like larger tapestry of Asian American cinema, you don't get to see that type of intersection between two distinct races and experiences. And so when it came to the character of Parker, it was fascinating for me because it kind of felt like she was like in many ways like a compassionate entry point for Antonio to like really get a conversation and dialogue with his own terms with identity. And I think he did a really wonderful job of weaving that with scenes from like the backyard barbecue, those, the stillness of just being confronted with the reality of like our ethnicity compared to our culture. So like, I'd love to know, like, obviously you had mentioned that like it was by design to, you know, pay homage and be respectful and reverent of like the Vietnamese community in New Orleans. But like, tell me more about like how you developed Parker from the ground up and like the elements that you put in, whether it be, you know, the inclusion of her being terminally ill to this, like the way that even the portrayal of the character was so, it wasn't like whimsical. It was like grounded. It was heartfelt and it was soulful. And the complementary nature that was in relation to Antonio's arc, because I think like a lot of people appreciate just having those dynamics between the Vietnamese community and the Korean community just done in a way that feels like arguably artful. So I'd love to hear more about like what went into that process.
Yeah. Parker served very much as a mentor figure to Antonio. You know, she is like a mirror to him, because when you're dealing with someone who's dying, it's really hard to trump their problems. So like, he really has to take a step back and look at his life and become introspective and look at himself honestly. So, you know, and the fact that she is Asian American makes him consider what he is as well and where he's possibly headed. Mm-hmm. And they're both going through a sort of a death. You know, she's going through a physical death and he's going through a death as an American. So there's a poetic nature to how they relate with one another. You know, in the party, like it's a glimpse into what his life could be like if he gets deported, but it's also possibly, you know, can remind him of maybe the family he never had. Yeah. You know, and sort of like it makes him become even more introspective. You know, because he has to come to terms with some of these things of the past and his feelings about them in order to move forward. You know, and Parker helps him get there. But, you know, Parker is also three-dimensional. It's not like she doesn't have problems of her own. Mm-hmm. You see that scene where she comes and asks for another tattoo. And he asks, like, you think this is therapy? She's also has her own demons and is a full three-dimensional human that has emotions. And so it's beautiful in that way. And that, I think that that's why you feel it's grounded. And the moments are deserved. Even the moment on the back of the motorcycle is deserved, because it's not like she was just some tool that was used for structural reasons. She is a full human being.
Yeah. I also wanted to note that the decision to sort of have Antonio's occupation as a tattoo artist, I interpreted that like from a figurative sense of the fact that his job contends with, you know, creating things that are permanent, when his own positioning in his own country is something that feels like it's wobbly or it's being questioned. So I think that decision, like almost artistically, to have that be his occupation was another kind of like frame of how we're seeing him find ways to kind of like stay and ingratiate himself within the grounds too. So yeah
absolutely.
Did you learn more like tattoo tricks while you were working you know, on the scenes and whatnot, to tell us a little more about that?
Oh yeah absolutely. I mean, I did have to know how to hold the gun and how it all worked, and, you know, basically know how to tattoo. I had a tattoo on my left side of my chest since I was 18. And I decided for the movie, you know, I wanted to cover it up for a long time. So I decided to just get an American traditional tattoo across my whole chest and not fill it in, just have the outline. And that's what I used for the film. You're seeing a real tattoo on my chest. And then also I got, you know, the A plus J, Antonio plus Jesse forever, but my daughter's name is Ilani, my name is Justin, so I kind of planned that. But my wife tattooed this in our hotel bathroom in New Orleans right before we shot the film. So I definitely had the experience of getting tattooed right before filming this movie. So
It's a literal body of work. I was always wondering, I was like, I feel like you're actually doing those scenes. Like there's like a concentration to it that you can't really teach. Yeah. You have to be about that life. So
yeah. It's a pretty all the way you know, commitment to be, you know, to do to for the film. I mean, yeah, I got these tattoos. If the film ended up not being very great, I'd be in big trouble. Get me accountable.
It's a little body of work. It's a little souvenir.
That's amazing.
When considering Blue Bayou, and like, I always go back to just like how we're all sort of preserving the canon, like contributing like our footprint to like a larger dialogue and really like conversation about like our identity. I think of films like, you know, from the past, like Gran Torino, and also recently like Minari, where there is like a detail about Asian Americans that aren't bicoastal. They aren't in LA or New York or San Francisco, and how the fact that the way that, you know, our communities ethnically speaking transfer, like whether it be by virtue of, you know, immigration or displacement, the attention that's given to a place, in this case, like the South and New Orleans, I kind of wondered, like, is it sort of like your goal, or like, how do you kind of see sort of like the trends of like going for the attractive locales or places that have a lot more population as compared to like a South where there are plenty of stories that are accountable and fully realized that just simply by virtue of just representation don't get that chance to be seen? I think it's kind of back to my first question about New Orleans, but in general, like you see that trend too, in terms of like the affinities for like the coastal elites and all that when it comes to Asian representation.
Well, you know, I mean, if you look at my films, they're always about blue collar people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that like when you look at Asian American film, it's typically at least middle class,
yeah.
You know, or and up to upper class. You rarely see a film about working class folks in Asian American film, rarely. And I don't know why. I don't know why. I think it's maybe our pride. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But you know, like you talk about Minari. Yeah, it's working class. You know, I think that's why that's why we relate to it, because, you know, these people, they're just trying to get on with it. And it represents the majority of us. I would doubt that the majority of us are so well off, and, you know, and that's just a facade. You know, I think that art, you know, is heightened life. And I think, you know, what I'd like to see is people that look like me and represent what I've been through. You know, and we do need entertainment. So that aspect is also important. So like the other films that are like escapism films are great, but my first and foremost agenda is always to bring empathy towards Asian Americans, regardless of where we're all from. And I want to cover the entire diaspora. You know, the newest film I filmed is about an Indonesian father and son, you know, and Rich Brian plays the son. And that's because, you know, I feel like the Southeast Asian, you know, part of our community is underrepresented, and no one thinks that's like, you know, glamorous right now. So like, you know, that's my job, is to use my platform, not to only service my own community. I think that if we start to tell each other stories responsibly, you know, we can become stronger.
Yeah. And I think what you discussed really alludes to sort of this larger framework of the desegregation of data with respect to the perceived like well-to-do and liveliness of like Asian Americans. And when that conversation happens, it oftentimes precludes the Southeast Asian experience and kind of like normalizes that, oh, because a certain prevalence of East Asians are doing well financially, culturally, that assumes that to the mild minority, that all of us have this sense of livelihood and longevity that, as you can see from films like your own, isn't always like a shared experience. So I think if films aren't like a lever to like express that, then policy has to be, and sometimes that doesn't pull through. So it's super important to have that. And I think like there is like a lot of discussion about like the ownership over those type of stories. And I think you're one of the very few filmmakers who has the intention and like the reverence to approach, you know, whether it be talking about an adoptee story or venturing into an ethnic demographic that isn't like our lived experience. But I often think sometimes that these conversations, there isn't like a parallel in like white communities per se, where like we're so,
yeah.
And you kind of seen with like the recent like showings of Asian American films, like there is such a specific criticism that even like as a publication myself, like I'm privy to like the way that we like eat our own. So like, I just want to say first and foremost, from like a writer to writer, it's like, I I empathize with that critique and like that specific stress, because I can imagine it can sometimes like get in the way of the process, like a little bit, huh?
Well, I will say that, yeah. I you know, something you said, it really is about the intention of it. Mm-hmm. Like why are you telling the story? What is the intention behind telling the story? And I think that's a very important question. You know, I will say, you know, like I know for a fact, like people are gonna have a problem that I'm not an adoptee, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm telling an adoptee story, you know. I just hope that they do see ultimately that I am trying to service them and represent them in film, you know, but, you know, that's their right, you know, that's, it's their story, you know, and all I can ask is that they just see that I have good intentions and I'm doing it for the right reasons, but, you know, amongst our community, it is tough. It is tough to, you know, and I've gotten for every film. I've gotten for every film I've made is there's a group of people that really don't like what I'm doing. But I can't, you know, I can't not do it because of that. You know, I can't like, you know, then why do I exist? Like, what is my purpose then in making art? You know, it's art by definition, I think is supposed to make you think and also create conversations amongst us, mm. even if it's discourse, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really tough, you know, I think, you know, because there's no sort of like end all be all sort of like verdict of how we should operate in these arenas and you know, how, like, in what way we need to support and how to support and or how to like, say something is wrong, but you know, we're also living in a time where it's like, you know, it's very much a cancel culture type of atmosphere. So it's very sensitive, you know, and we have to walk that tightrope and hope that our intentions are true.
Totally.
Because, you know, people can feel offended.
Yeah. And there's this larger kind of like gamut of like ideological purity that through the lens of the internet and social media has made like creatives being put in sort of like a pickle sometimes. So again, I'm empathetic to the situation. I just want to say just like, not as someone who obviously like understands your work, but like as someone who like you, we're all just simply trying to figure shit out at the end of the day in terms of like,
yeah, that's all it is.
The truth from the haze and, you know, to just kind of to hearken it back to the film, when it comes to like the visual identity and like the things like the artisanal elements, there are some very intriguing and are very, very powerful sequences in the film that for me, like showcase your ability from like a visual mastery in terms of like the lyrical usage of film and the settings, whether it be like Antonio's favorite spot near the river to like the underwater sequences. It feels like water in general was like a very big visual language of the film. So what role did that play for you in sort of like developing? I know Blue Bayou obviously is literally water itself, but I'm wondering how that like was interpreted from a director perspective as much as a writing one.
I mean, we could get super frou-frou about this, you know, like, you know, we can get super frou-frou and I can be like super full of myself and speak about all the reasons I did, you know, use the water. And I really haven't spoken too much about it because ultimately my question is, how does it make you feel? Yeah. That's what matters. You know, that's what matters. But, you know, there are all intentional choices. I mean, if you notice, like, you know, there's three times that it rains in the film. And, you know, each of those times is like when something really, you know, bad is happening in Antonio's life, people will never pick up on that, but they'll feel it, you know, like when he gets arrested, it's raining. And then when, you know, he's stealing the motorcycles, it's raining. And then finally, when he goes into the bayou, it's raining. Well, you know, like when we got frou-frou, that's like his mother's tears, you know, you know, and the regret and the remorse, you know, of giving up the child and like him feeling that, you know, and also the feeling some sense of like love from his mother. But it doesn't matter. You know, it really doesn't matter. Like all these sort of like artisanal things mm-hmm. that, you know, I designed is just there to make you feel. Yeah. Right. And at the end of the day, is a movie effective or not in getting you to empathize with someone who's going through, you know, the deportation process and also the experience as an adoptee, that particular experience as an adoptee? Does it make you empathize? If it does, then all those things are worthwhile. If it doesn't, we got bigger problems. We got some big problems, you know?
I couldn't have said it better myself too. And that, I think you really just sort of like fasten around the main point about, you know, the role of filmmaking and honestly the role of taking on uncomfortable subjects. We can take on the most frou-frou ideals and fanciful things, but ultimately what does it ultimately say about the world is just like the pervading question. So I think that's a ideal way to kind of not only kind of conclude the interview, but again, just to congratulate you on being in this position that you are now to just take on tough stories and approach them with a lot of sort of like, honestly, joy about the process. So really, Justin, thank you so much for taking part of our podcast and being here. And I guess my last question is like, obviously, what are you working on next? Anything you wanted to share with our viewers who obviously have been following you for some time?
Yeah, you know, I did the TV adaptation of the book Pachinko. I did half of the season. I think it's coming out like end of the year. And then I just finished shooting a film about the Indonesian father and son, where Rich Brian plays the son and he's a rapper about to blow up and his dad has been his manager. He's just fired his dad and gained like a white manager and label. And basically it's a brand story between father and son. So that's like my next film I'll be releasing.
Sounds terrific. Can't wait to check it out and hopefully we'll be able to discuss it then. Well, until
absolutely.
Next time, Justin, it's been really a pleasure. And for our readers and our viewership, be sure to check out Blue Bayou arriving in theaters this Friday, September 17th. Justin, see you next time.
See you next time. You know, man.